Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Going Underground, and Radio Deutsche Welle. We will begin with France 24. For the 7th year in a row, Finland was voted the happiest country in the world, while the United States dropped to 23rd, the lowest spot since the poll began. There has been strong criticism of Netanyahu in the Israeli press. Canada is to halt all arms shipments to Israel, joining Belgium, Italy, and Netherlands. However, the U.S. supplies 69% and Germany supplies 30% of all Israeli weapon imports. France 24.
It's a country with a high concentration of metal bands where speeding fines are based on income, and it's the official home of Santa Claus. But is that a recipe for happiness? Finland has again taken the top spot in the World Happiness Report, where people in 143 countries and territories are asked to evaluate their life satisfaction from 0 to 10. Nordic countries dominated the top 10, while Afghanistan and Lebanon remain the 2 unhappiest countries in the survey. In broad terms, the rankings are loosely correlated with a country's prosperity, though other factors such as personal freedom, lack of corruption, and access to nature also seem to influence assessments.
Wealth does matter, but especially also how wealth is distributed. So in Finland, Denmark, and the other Scandinavian countries, you'll find that wealth is way more evenly distributed. So more people benefit from the wealth that's being generated in these countries. And then also each one supports a welfare state that provides psychological stability.
The United States dropped out of the top 20 for the first time, falling to 23rd place from 15th, after a decrease in the sense of well-being of young Americans. Experts say a range of factors could be to blame, including social media, increased polarization over social issues, and the difficulty for young people to afford their own homes. The report also found younger generations weren't as happy as their elders in Canada and Japan, and to a lesser extent in France, Germany, and Britain.
Strong criticism of Benjamin Netanyahu in the Israeli press this morning, Leah.
Yeah, so this is in Haaretz, the left-leaning Israeli paper that has been very critical of the PM since the events of October the 7th. This morning, they say that there's nothing that Joe Biden can do to remove Netanyahu. They say that the US president is rightly frustrated at a man who they say is incapable of taking responsibility for what happened on October the 7th. Joe Biden has supported Israel to the hilt. In return, Netanyahu has turned down all of Biden's requests that Israel take more care in avoiding casualties and any sort of ceasefire. Haaretz say that Biden's support for Israel will not waver, but instead he's targeting solely the PM himself, and he's encouraged political heavyweights such as Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to publicly criticise Netanyahu. This article finishes by saying that the only realistic way of getting rid of Netanyahu is dissolving the parliament and holding early elections, and the Biden administration has absolutely no influence over that.
Now, in related news, Canada is to halt all arms shipments to Israel amid the war in Gaza, the first major Western ally of Israel to do so. The Israeli government has strongly condemned that decision, its foreign minister Israel Katz saying it undermines the country's right to defend itself. Well, France 24's Andrew Hillier has been looking into this for us. He's with me now. Andrew, what more can you tell us about that decision by Canada?
Well, Nadja, this decision came about after a non-binding vote in the Canadian Parliament. It effectively means that Canada will, in future, halt all arms shipments to Israel. Important to point out, however, that in reality, there haven't been any arms exports from Canada to Israel since January. And even since October, Canada has only been exporting non-lethal shipments to Israel. That's communications equipments like radios, for example. Now, from the Canadians' perspective, this is a significant move. That's because Israel has historically been one of the top recipients of Canadian weapons. In 2021, Canada exported around 17.5 million euros worth of weapons to Israel. In 2022, that figure went down to around 14 million euros. And I think this is part of a trend that we've been seeing in Canada recently. Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has been increasingly critical of Israel's conduct in Gaza, particularly in light of those mounting civilian deaths. Of course, outrage in Israel, as you mentioned there, the Foreign Minister, Israel Katz, saying that it undermined Israel's right to self-defense. He also said that history would judge Canada's current action harshly.
Do you think then this decision is going to have a big impact?
Well, look, you know, Canada isn't the only country that's moved recently to stop arms exports to Israel. We've seen similar moves lately from Belgium, Italy, and the Netherlands. In fact, in February, there was quite a well-known case in the Netherlands brought about by three NGOs, which resulted in a court ordering the Netherlands to halt shipments of F-35 fighter jet parts to Israel because of concerns they would be used to violate international law. In Italy, the situation is more complicated. That's because exports of outstanding contracts have continued. The government there insists that it's only honouring previously signed orders. Now, as to the question, have these decisions have any impact or will they have an impact? The answer is not as much as you may think. And that's because, as you're about to see on your screen, the majority of Israel's arms imports only come from two countries. As you can see there, 69% between 2019 and 2023 coming from the US, 30% from Germany, and that tiny, tiny slither there coming from 1% from Italy and other countries. So imports, Israel's arms imports from the US and Germany vastly outweighing imports from other countries. Little sign of those two countries slowing down weapons shipments to Israel. In fact, Germany has even increased the amount of weapons it exports to Israel since October.
Andrew Hillier, thank you.
Those reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com. as well as on YouTube at a channel called France 24 English and at most podcast sites. On to Afshin Ratansi's Going Underground. Afshin spoke with Daniel Levy, a peace negotiator who is part of the Taba and Oslo summits and currently serves as president of the U.S. Middle East Project. They discussed the role the U.S. plays in enabling the Israeli war in Palestine. Levy says that the U.S. has global political framing for the Middle East region, with Israel and a few Arab states as allies, and that the U.S. has a history of colonizing many parts of the world beside North America. He says America has the leverage to cease the war, but it would never happen with a single phone call, but requires sustained actions. They discussed the possibility of a regional war beyond the US-UK bombing in Yemen, how Israel has developed impunity for actions in the region, and the need to break the US and West monopoly on ending conflicts. Does the world need an effective world court? And should the Global South be included in creating worldwide order? Going underground.
Joining me now is Daniel Levy, a veteran Israeli peace negotiator who participated in the official delegations for the Taba negotiations under Barak and the Oslo talks under Rabin. Levy currently serves as the president of the U.S. Middle East Project. He joins me now from London. Clearly, Netanyahu couldn't do what he wants to do along with the other far-right members of the coalition. without the enablers of the genocide. So every time people watching this hear the name Netanyahu being spat out by Biden or Sunak or Ursula von der Leyen, is it really not, I mean, I'm not being a Netanyahu apologist, is it not Netanyahu's fault?
Lead correspondent in the free mass circulation Israeli daily Israel Hayom, their correspondent said categorically Israel could not continue this war were it not for the American military support. Now, we have seen even in American media, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, have exposed that what we do in terms of a flow of American weaponry. But they've also pointed out that because under these conditions, certain arms transfers would need to undergo a degree of congressional scrutiny. What the administration has done is create end runs, even around the scrutiny that would have to occur within its own system in order to keep providing the artillery shells, 2,000-pound bombs, the JDAMs, the missiles, etc., most of which are not defensive, of course, most of which are the offensive weaponry, which has caused this devastation. Because if you break these arms transfers down into smaller chunks, they don't have to go through that accountability transparency cycle. So, and this, of course, is a very obvious pointer as to if anyone wanted to end this, how they could end this, you stop arming it. America has a geopolitical management framing for the Middle East region. It involves certain, you've called Israel a client state. I'm not sure I'd use the word client, but it involves certain states in the Arab state system that are very close to the US. It involves Israel as a central node. And if Israel's acting up a bit, maybe stepping beyond the lines that the US would rather it confined itself to, that is still not going to interrupt the fundamental geopolitics. It's much easier if an administration can tell us a global geopolitical story of good guys and bad guys, and what Israel and others have done to disrupt that is really quite significant. And finally, we should not tell ourselves this story that this is so out of sync with American values. I mean, one settler colonial society to another. There may be a gap here of 100 or more years. But going back to this point about picking up the phone, because this is also part of the story. For the Netanyahu government to let what's needed in by way of humanitarian assistance and to end the kinds of actions it is taking in Gaza, I think would require a sustained standoff. In other words, it's not just that first phone call. It's after week one, after week two, you're not providing the weapons. You're not vetoing stuff at the UN Security Council. You would need to be able to sustain this. I think they know that. I think they do not read their own politics as allowing them to do that, because Netanyahu will push back. It will take time. I believe that the Israeli system, the military, the public will not sustain the non-provision, especially of American weapons, and the military especially will say, listen, guy, we don't care what story you tell yourself, you tell the public, but you're going to have to move in the direction they're telling you to. So yes, America has the leverage. No, it's not one phone call. Yes, they have their own reasons for not using that leverage.
Is this paving the way for expansion into a regional war? I don't know what you think of the British and American airstrikes on Yemen for showing solidarity with the Palestinians in their enforcing of an embargo. I mean, the word Iran keeps being mentioned in the United States as part of political rhetoric all the time, as it does in Europe increasingly.
Let me quote you what the Swedish former Prime Minister, Foreign Minister Carl Bildt. He said, maybe we should take seriously the idea that if we want to end what's going on in the Red Sea and resume shipping lanes in an uninterfered way, rather than bombing Yemen, end the war in Gaza. So this is someone from the heart of that establishment acknowledging a reality which is just staring us in the face. The Houthis have been very open about why they're doing this. And I think sometimes one should take people at face value. So yes, the idea that that you can distinguish between these two things. Just get the ceasefire in Gaza if you want to at least calm to some degree the region. This is not going well for the West. It's not going well on the battlefield for Israel. The balance of forces, Israel, of course, has the firepower to kill Gazan civilians, but this is not a display of strength when you're doing this. It's a display of weakness when you won't send your infantry in, so you just bomb and bomb and bomb. Regionally, Iran is not deployed directly. Hezbollah has only played a role up to a certain level, tying down some Israeli forces in the north. So without those two major actors, you still have a catastrophic Israeli own goal in terms of the political, legal, moral, reputational jeopardy that it is engaged in. And you have this successful Houthi intervention to disrupt global trade. So it's not going well. Maybe even in its own interest terms, the West should be looking at this again. Netanyahu is not popular. The military operation is popular. And I just think this speaks to the fact that the Israeli public have gotten used to impunity. And that's the ultimate culpability of Israel's allies in getting us to this moment, because by never holding Israel accountable, you have been the handmaiden to extremism, and you normalize everything that Israel has done. You normalize that apartheid, you normalize Ben-Gvir and Smotrich being in the government. So bringing this back then to what does it mean for the US monopoly on peace efforts? And those peace efforts are a sham. That is the story of so-called peacemaking in the last decade, two decades, perhaps. I think anyone who's serious about wanting to get this to a place where the events of October 6th, when things were terrible for Palestinians, October 7th, when things were terrible for Israelis, and every day since, anyone who wants to get beyond that needs to look at a different architecture, a different way of doing that. I think that has to break the US and Western monopoly.
Is the ICJ also on trial here, the so-called World Court? It could have ordered a cease and desist order immediately, which would have prevented arms trading from Western European countries. Time for a look at this World Court while we witness this genocide on a day-by-day, hour-by-hour basis.
I don't think so, because I think what the provisional measures ordered by the court amounted to was the things that should then have been...
Well, it was open to interpretation, which isn't good enough. They could have put their foot down.
Well, even if they put their foot down, it then has to be implemented, right? It's not none of this. The point here, Avshin, I think, is none of this is self-implementing. A Security Council resolution isn't self-implementing. An ICJ ruling, as we know from other instances, none of this is self-implementing. They do not have the power to implement. It then depends on other actors, whether they're going to ignore what the court has said. Of course, they can't ignore what the court could have said, but they've ignored what the court has said. Israel had 30 days to report. Israel provided a report that has not been made public. The South Africans have now gone back with a request for further provisional measures. But whatever the court rules, it is up to those who claim they want to be in good standing with international legality to either abide by those rulings or, as you suggest, to further take an axe to the institutional international structures of global governance and the ability just to do anything by ignoring those rulings. And I think what the events and the response to those events of the last months have shown us is that we do not have anything even approaching an international order fit for purpose, and that's a really dangerous place to be. And I think whether it's Israel in its moment right now or that global architecture, this is a dangerous time. You refer to other conflicts going on, and I agree with you. And I think the global South is looking at this and say, and it's interesting, the Americans in the West aren't even trying anymore to pass resolutions to win people over for their claims elsewhere in the world, because they have no standing whatsoever.
Daniel Levy, thank you.
That interview was excerpted from Afshin Mertansi's twice-weekly program called Going Underground. It is available at Apple Podcast and other podcast sites, as well as rumble.com with video. The entire interview is worth hearing. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this listener-funded program, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Your donations help support the weekly production and distribution of this show, which is supplied freely to more than 100 radio stations across the globe. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The U.S. government has found no evidence of brain injuries from the so-called Havana syndrome, which was first alleged in Cuba in 2016. Farmers across Europe are continuing their road blockage protest against what they say is too much government overreach, environmental regulation, and forced importation of duty-free Ukrainian produce flooding their markets. A climate researcher and delegate to the climate change conferences from Stanford University describes what the world might look like in 20 to 30 years if we continue on our current environmental path. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
A U.S. government study has found no evidence of brain injuries amongst diplomats and embassy officials who've reported symptoms of so-called Havana syndrome. Researchers said there were no cognitive differences between sufferers and a control group. Headaches and cognitive problems were first reported by embassy workers in Cuba in 2016.
Well, for weeks now, farmers in countries across Europe have been protesting against what they say is too much red tape, too much government overreach that threatens their livelihoods. Farmers are also upset about cheaper Ukrainian imports flooding the market. Well, today, farmers again blocked roads in European countries ahead of tomorrow's EU summit, which they hope will address their concerns.
Building fires in the middle of roads. Polish farmers are once again blocking traffic in nationwide protests. They brought their tractors and even a coffin they say symbolizes the death of agriculture.
Spring is coming. There will be expenses for fertilizers, fuel, and everything else. These things are very expensive. I don't know how long I'll last.
Protesting high costs and low produce prices. It's part of a three-month action plan by farmers across the EU. Many of them blame their woes on the EU's environmental regulations. They say they add more bureaucracy, leaving farmers with even larger bills.
We're fighting for the abolition of the Green Deal. That's our top priority.
Protests in the Czech Republic, too. Much of the farmers' anger is also directed at cheaper Ukrainian produce making its way into the EU, tax-free, and without having to conform to strict EU rules.
The biggest problem are the ridiculous regulations. Importing grain from Ukraine would not be a problem if it were done under the same conditions as we have here and with the same taxes that we pay.
They claim those imports are driving down the prices of their own produce. So far, the European Commission has denied the imports have a, quote, significant impact on prices, while the EU has reached a provisional deal that would continue allowing duty-free Ukrainian products until mid-2025, with new caps on some food imports like oats and corn. Farmers are now waiting for the outcome from Brussels, where EU leaders are set to meet for a two-day summit.
Well, Henna Hondel is a delegate to the UN Climate Change Conferences and a climate and policy researcher at Stanford University in the USA. I asked her what the world would look like in 20 to 30 years if we continue on our current path.
I think based on current projections, what we're really preparing for is destruction to habitats, loss of flora and fauna, and unlivable conditions in many parts of the world. You know, we've seen heat waves increase in intensity, duration, and frequency. We're seeing tropical cyclones increase in intensity and a greater proportion of them being category 4 and 5. We're seeing youth talk about the mental health impacts of climate change. A really interesting study was done just a couple years ago, surveying 10,000 youth in 10 countries, and nearly half said that their feelings about climate change affect their daily lives. So this is not a pretty picture. And the WMO just came out with a report recently showing that pre-pandemic levels of food insecurity have dramatically increased in the past year, up to more than 300 million people experiencing food insecurity due to climate change. So this is a really grim picture. And I think it's high time that we get governments involved to actually get a grip on it.
Right. That grim picture is a familiar one. Why do you think that, given that we all know what's going on, why isn't climate change being combated faster?
You know, I think the messaging is really key here. One of my favorite quotes from Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, is when he said that the storyteller is the most powerful person because they set the vision, the agenda, and the values of the future. And when we think about climate change, how are we actually telling that story? Are we conveying it in a sort of distant, disconnected sense, or are we actually highlighting the real economic and health impacts that are affecting people in the here and now? You know, it's been projected that coastal flooding will lead to €1 trillion worth of losses, just affecting Europe. So that's huge. But are we actually conveying those realities in a way that people feel connected to it in their day-to-day lives? So I think we have a lot of work to be done on that messaging front.
So I think you posed the statement as a question. Are you saying that we are not doing sufficient to put that message across? Because it seems to me you can barely turn on a TV these days without seeing someone getting flooded or someone having a drought or this river having dried up, whether it's in Europe or Bangladesh or anywhere.
Yeah, so I think, unfortunately, in the past year, those effects have come to people's doorsteps. And we're actually seeing more and more people being directly impacted by climate change and really feeling that in a way that I actually think could end up catalyzing more action. For example, this week, South Sudan is actually shutting down schools due to a heat wave expecting to last for the next 2 weeks. We've seen in 2 years ago in the UK, roads were buckling under a really devastating heat wave in the summer of July 2023. So I think as these impacts, unfortunately, come to the doorstep of people, they're going to feel it more deeply. But what I had hoped for is that people wouldn't have to feel it so deeply for that messaging to really hit, that governments and policy experts could do a better job of articulating these challenges before the crisis actually hit.
Thank you so much for joining us, Henna Hundel from Stanford University. Thank you.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as at most podcast sites. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You'll have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for making online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 27th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 26 years, this Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I am recuperating from spinal surgery, I am staying at a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.